Accession number 12578, Reel 1.
Mr. Hall, Reel 1. Can we start with your telling me something about your family background, where you were born, what your father did for a living, and where you went to school, please?
Yep, well, I was born in November 1919 at Kingston-on-Thames in my grandparents' house. But we soon moved to a house in Tolworth, just by Surbiton, where we stayed until I left for the war. My father was a clerk in the Gaslight & Co. Company, very miserable as a clerk in the Gaslight & Co. Company, saying he hated every working day. But I remember in the Depression him being so thankful to have a job of any sort. He had signed on for the Gaslight & Co. Company before the First World War, and was thankful when the war ended to have a job to go back to. He met my mother, who was also in the war, as a in what I think was called the WACS in those days. And they were both in uniform. They got leave to come home to get married. And while they were on leave getting married, the armistice was signed, so my father went back, and she didn't. She stayed home. And then a year later, well, November 1919, I was born. I was the eldest of three children, my brother, 3.5 years younger than me, and a sister, 10 years younger than me. I went to Tiffin Boys' School in Kingston, and eventually got a scholarship, what was called in those days a Surrey County Major Scholarship, to university, which was an innovation for anybody in my family. Nobody's ever, I don't think, heard of a university, let alone been to one. So I went up to Queen Mary College in London. And, of course, when war broke out, there was a crisis in London University. Everybody thought they were going to get bombed. And London University was dispersed around the country. And we were lucky enough to be dispersed to Cambridge. And so I spent my final year as a student of Queen Mary College, but at King's College in Cambridge. The year at Cambridge was traumatic, of course, because of the war. It was traumatic for me as somebody pretty well penniless, because I used to go up with 30 shillings each term. So I couldn't enjoy myself in the way that Cambridge undergraduates were supposed to, and I did nothing really but work. However, the result of all that was, not through being clever, but through all that work, I got a first, which had some consequences. I can remember very clearly the awful period of Dunkirk and the Battle for France, because our final examinations were during the Battle for France, and I remember clearing up one night with some other friends some project work we had to submit after the exams were finished over the Dunkirk period. And one night I can remember when we looked out of the window and worked most of the night, the hallowed lawn of King's College was covered in the debris of men and vehicles that had driven back from the ports, where they come straight from the ports to find billets in King's College and all over Cambridge. So it was an awful time to be taking examinations. One felt moved immediately to join up, but there seemed to be total chaos at the time, and before we knew where we were, the only other guy with a first in electrical engineering, which is what I'd taken, and myself were called up to London to meet be interviewed by a civil servant called Brundrett. I always remember his name, in the Admiralty. And there were quite a few young men there, Steve Cook went in for the interview before me because his name began with C. And when he came out, I remember saying to him, "Well, Stephen, what are we going to do?" And he said, with some horror, "We're going to Alexandria to degauss ships." And that sounded a rather boring thing to do. But I suppose it was a much less exciting, by the way, than going into the army, which is what we both wanted to do. But when I went in, it was nothing about degaussing ships. I was told to report to Worth Matravers near Swanage as soon as possible. Now that was a very strange coincidence, because Swanage had been the place of our family holidays before the war, and my parents and I, and brother and sister, we knew Swanage very well, we knew Worth Matravers very well, and we knew Worth Matravers as a little tiny peaceful village with nothing there. What on earth I was to find when I got there, I had no idea. But when I did get there on the 1st of June 1940, I found an establishment called MAPRE, Ministry of Aircraft Production Research Establishment, where I was told I would be an assistant grade 3 in the scientific civil service, temporary. And this was the lowest of the low in the scientific grade, which was quite right. I was only 20, remember. I'd never done any work except vacation work and things like that, but I'd never done any scientific work. I didn't know what research was all about. It was all going to be rather traumatic, being thrown into research work straight away like that. Although I was the lowest of the low on the scientific grade, I discovered that there was a class distinction in the civil service, and there was a technical grade as well. And these were these were the lower orders, the non-commissioned ranks, so to speak, people who hadn't got degrees. So I wasn't quite the lowest. I remember on that first day there, I was interviewed by a fellow called W.B. Lewis, who was the deputy superintendent of the place, and who subsequently became director of the nuclear establishment at Chalk River in Canada. He showed me, he didn't talk to me much at all. He just gave me three files to read. One was labelled CH, one was labelled CHL, and one was labelled AI. And he said, "Go away and read those, tell me which one you want to work on." Well, I looked at these files and I didn't understand a word of what was in any of them. It was complete mystery to me. But I said, "I'll work on that one," for no particular reason. I didn't understand it anyway, and that was CHL. The CHL turned out to be a 200 megacycle radar for detecting lower flying aircraft. But I found that the daylight Battle of Britain was on by this time, and it was really total chaos, and nobody seemed to know what to do with a young, inexperienced 20-year-old anyway. And so one spent some time doing odd jobs and just finding your feet about what it was all about. But we did have some interesting things to do. I remember being sent from Swanage, from Worth Matravers, to Ventnor one day with an oscillator, and told to install this oscillator at the top of one of the CH towers on the top of the St. Boniface cliffs at Ventnor, where there was a CH station. And this was an adventure for me. It was also very frightening, because getting this oscillator at the top of this tower, which is about 240 feet tall, at the top of about a 900-foot cliff, I'd never done anything like that before. And it was in cloud. And on hearing aircraft approaching, one wondered whether these were friendly or whether they were foe, whether they were the enemy. And one knew that they were quite likely to start bombing CH stations. In any case, in that cloud, they could easily have driven straight into me. So that was a vivid memory at the time.
But Battle of Britain was going on at this time.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you see much of the dogfight?
Oh, we saw quite a lot. We saw quite a lot going on there. We didn't. We were sort of a wee bit west of the worst of it all, of course, but we did see quite a lot, and there was quite a lot of activity around Swanage. I suspect that there were a few German aircraft that were looking at what all this was about in the area. This big establishment there, or big by those standards of those days, and aircraft. We did see aircraft flying over the town many times. Fighters strafed the town once or twice. Nothing very serious there. It was rumoured that somebody's mother got shot through the bottom of her foot while she was playing bowls, which was an unusual wound, into the sole of her foot and out the top. It sounds horrendous, but it didn't seem horrendous at the time. One interesting few nights we had when I was there was helping to try and find ways of making the long aerial mine system work. Long aerial mines were explosives which were fixed at the top of a long piece of piano wire, which had a weight at the bottom and a parachute at the top. And an old aeroplane like a Harrow we used, or a Hampden, I can't remember which, used to go out loaded with these damn things. And then when enemies were on the way in, you would try and sew these mines in front of the enemy that would then perhaps fly into the wires, one of the hanging wires. The jerk on it would release the explosive, which would run down the wire and bang into the wing of the aeroplane. Well, whether we actually destroyed any enemy aircraft, we will never know. But there was an occasion when we believed one radar blip disappeared as it went through our minefield. We sowed the minefield using a CH station which was on halfway down the cliff at Worth Matravers, called D Site. And if you go there today, and I went there a year ago, you can still see the remains of the bits and pieces that we had there. It was also rumoured that the only real known casualty was one of our mines, which landed in Bournemouth, and a policeman, unfortunately, lost his foot. But this was a rumour. Whether it was true or not, well, we'll never know. Many, many years later, around about 1970, I discovered that a lad that was working for me in ICL was one of the corporals that was at D site, in that little radar station when we were doing that work. Also, another odd job I was given was to go and help the AI people at and try and make sure that AI worked with the ground radar defences properly at Middle Wallop, where they were using AI Mark IVs, which is an old 200 megacycle AI, which was not very good. But the squadron there was the first squadron to be fitted out with bow fighters. I don't think they had them at that time. I think they were still flying Blenheims, but they were eventually with bow fighters. And, of course, there was the great Cat's Eyes Cunningham, whom I met, and his AI operator was one Sergeant Jackson, who I remember being very impressed with, as it was alleged he was one of the few people in the world that owned a newspaper, was a fellow of the Royal Society, and had ridden in the Grand National. Anyway, that all happened between June the 1st when I joined and October. I was at Middle Wallop sorting out all this AI stuff. It was always very strange, and this kept on happening, being a civilian, or one of what a civilian living on RAF stations for week for days, sometimes weeks at a time. The only person in the officers' mess who was not in a uniform.
I don't, just talking about this period of June, October 1940, I don't get the impression from what you're saying that you had any sense of national crisis, that you felt that the country was about to be invaded by the Germans.
Well, you're right. If I've given that impression, I think at the time, as a young man of 20, working with all these very clever people, one had enormous confidence in what was going on. One felt that we would overcome these difficulties. I have, in fact, looked up some letters that I wrote to my mother and father at the time. And although they don't indicate any feeling of crisis, they do, and I was probably breaking security, doing things that I shouldn't do. I was saying to them that while they were going through this hell of the, this was later on, the night bombers and all that, and we were working very hard, we were not being very successful at doing anything about it. But eventually, we would pull through. That was the sort of attitude, that we're doing badly at the moment, but there is no way that we could lose. And one had this, I certainly had this feeling. But remember, I was only 20 years old. Certainly had that feeling. And had a lot of confidence. We'd just got this great leader in Churchill, and we had some clearly great people at TRE, whom I admired enormously, who were devoting enormous effort to try and sort out the technical problems of putting us technically on top of the Germans.
Who by name?
Well, people like Coburn and Lovell and Lewis and Dee and the superintendent, Jimmy Rowe, who was not a great scientist, but he was a great man for making these people who really were great people work together, and all the prima donnas. And they were united in hating him, which is probably his great strength. But they were a great gang of people, there's no question about that. And as I'm sure you've found in talking to them, a lot of them have done great things since. People like Lovell and my immediate boss, Martin Ryle. People like Henry Brown. People like... Henry Brown was slightly more junior, but people like Ryle and Lovell, all those people, done big things since the war. They were a great gang of people to be... One felt you couldn't be... As a young man of 20, you couldn't be in a more privileged group of... You couldn't have a greater privilege than work, if you're in the scientific field, of working with those people. The only snag was you felt very inadequate in that company, because they'd all had so much more experience than people like me who'd come in straight from college. And there was this enormous expansion. Almost everyone one worked with had more experience than you did. I didn't have many people who were as new as I was to the game. Anyway, in November 1940, by this time, as you know, the German night offensive had begun, and there had been prior to that a build-up of ideas about how to control night fighters to help them find the individual German bomber. And it was clear from the work we'd done at Middle Wallop that just sending them up in the air with AI equipment, they would never find anything, because the range wasn't long enough. And if they did see something on their radar, it would just flip past them, and they would never be able to turn quick enough to get onto the to get their guns laid. The only way to shoot down a bomber at night was to come upon it from the rear. And so there had to be some technique whereby you could put the night fighter on the tail of a bomber and then hope you had enough speed to catch him up probably from underneath, just underneath and behind him, to shoot in the belly. Now that required control of the fighter from the ground until such time as the fighter could pick up the bomber on his own airborne radar. And the system that was developed for that was a thing called GCI, Ground Controlled Interception Radars. These were modifications of the CHL, the low-flying detecting systems, and they were mobile. They had to be mobile because there was no time to put in permanent places. They were built in lorries made at a factory at Park Royal, and there was a transmitter lorry, there was a receiver and operations room lorry, and there were two trailers that each carried an aerial, a receiver aerial and a transmitting aerial, and there's another lorry with a big diesel engine in it. And six of these were built, and by November 1940 teams were put together to go and install these. And the idea was that the RAF should have a senior controller actually sitting in this radar, sitting in the trailer, as speaking directly to the night fighter, whereas all the previous control systems for the daylight raids and everything, the radar information went to central sector control rooms, where the radar information was plotted. Now we expected, we cut out all that administrative and long trail of passing information from radar stations to a control room, to a WAF, to plotting it. We cut all that out, and we had the controller actually looking at the radar looking at the radar himself and talking directly to the night fighter. And that enabled us to be much more responsive, quick. And one of the first of these, the D-site thing at Swanage, at Duethma Travers, was the sort of beginnings of those ideas. Now, when we the first one of these GCI sites was at Durrington near West Worthing, and I went there in November 1940, just coming up to my 21st birthday, which was the 13th of November. And well, we did our best to control aeroplanes, to control night fighters, and I can't remember how much success we had. We can't have had very much success, otherwise I'd have remembered. We had some very exciting times, though, and I think we certainly gave the Air Force night fighters a lot of confidence, and we gave them a lot of contacts. And I'm sure we did shoot some down. We certainly shot some down. How many, I can't remember, and how much of an effect that had on the night bombing war, I don't know. But the...
In what way was it so exciting for you, though?
Well, to actually see... I was in the control room with the RAF. I was always there during operations, quite apart from the technical job of making this thing work and seeing that it worked properly and training the RAF to make it work. We had to train the control. Because we were alleged to be clever people, we were supposed to know about everything, and we were supposed to be able to tell a wing commander how to control his... to work out what he got to do, tell him how to use the equipment, tell him, and find ways in which the air battle could be fought better. We had a very wide remit to see that those stations did a total job. And so developing the ideas was quite an exciting thing to do. We had some funny incidents. I can remember one in which the language is a bit odd, but the fighter's response to what he's being told, it was a loud speaking RT, you see, so we could hear the fighter speaking to all of us. When the controller said, do this, do that, he would respond and we could hear him. And when he saw a German, when he saw the enemy, he would say, okay, well, the technique was, when we got him behind and behind the enemy, we would say, flash your weapon. Now that meant that he would switch his radar on, because if we didn't want him driving around the skies with his radar on, unless it was going to be useful to him, because the enemy could pick it up and avoid him. So as soon as we felt that when he switched it on, he would be able to see the enemy and home on him, we then said, flash your weapon and away you go. Well, all our fighters were Lenims, and later, I don't think they were then in the Durrington days, bow fighters. But there was a squadron or two of Poles, the Polish Air Force, who'd come over, a mad lot, who flew around the skies with much care, with much abandon, but insisted on getting into the night fighting act. And they had single-engine aeroplanes. And they took the view that, and we tried to control them, but it was difficult. And I'll give you one comment of theirs in a minute. Because they took the view that any aeroplane that had two engines was an enemy, and therefore it should be shot down. The few British night fighters around with two engines, like the Blenheims, they were insignificant. If they got in the way, they'd be shot down as well. So they were rather a dangerous lot. But one night we were trying to control a Polish pilot, and the controller was saying, do this, do that. And over the loudspeaker, in front of all these WAFs, well, three or four WAFs that were there, came, cannot understand fucking English, switching off. And that language created a great furore in the WAFs in those days, I can tell you. But it was, then he went his own way. But more seriously, one of the difficulties with these radars was that they were very accurate on range, of course, and pretty accurate on azimuth. But height was always a problem. And we experimented with various ways of calibrating the thing for height. And one of the ways was to have what we called a squigging oscillator, which was an oscillator, on the frequency of the receiver, radar receiver, and you'd put that somewhere at a certain range and at a certain height, and then you would actually measure it by the radar. You'd know what actual height it was, and you would measure it on the radar, so you would know that that was the calibration, that was the that reading on the radar meant that height. And you did this all the way around at all the 360 degrees azimuth. Now, it's easier said than done to say put an oscillator over there at a certain height. And I said, right, well, what the easiest thing to do is to fly an aeroplane, and we'll circle the radar station, circle the GCI at a constant radius and at a constant height. And as it goes round, boys will be able to tell exactly where it is, azimuth and range, and they will measure what height it said, and the aircraft will be flying at a certain height, so it'll be fine. We'll do that at various heights, you see. Now, I suspect that this idea came to me came from somebody, but I certainly took it up because I'd never been in an aeroplane, never flown in my life. And I thought this would be a marvellous opportunity to go flying. So there was an experimental flying unit at Shoreham with run by a fellow called Chamberlain, who I notice is in Hanbury Brown's book.